I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned in to Modus Operandi, the show that explores the methods and patterns of foreign policy all around the world and the history that reverberates in our lives today. This week, we'll explore the highly contested visit to Taiwan by the U.S. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Despite Beijing's demands, America's third in line to the White House defied the One China policy the United States claims to respect. How will this visit impact the already tense relations between China and the U.S.? Then, in a low-profile manner, another island gets a visit by a U.S. delegation. The Solomon Islands in the South Pacific hosted the Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, and the U.S. Ambassador to Australia, Caroline Kennedy, daughter of the late U.S. President John F. Kennedy. The State Department says this diplomatic visit is to commemorate the Battle of Guadalcanal in World War II. But the other agencies traveling with these two diplomats are raising questions. All right, let's get into the MO. Sovereignty in the world of politics is generally defined and accepted as a nation's supreme right to act independently without outside interference to do that which it feels best serves its national interests. And that has been the subject of debate over Taiwan for hundreds of years. From its native population, predating written history of the island, to the questionable 300-year rule by the Ming Dynasty of mainland China in the 1300s, to the stint of Dutch colonialism in the 1600s. Taiwan's sovereignty has been disputed all through history. So when House Speaker Nancy Pelosi chose to make a short stop in Taiwan in early August 2022, did she effectively defy Beijing's request not to come and break the One China policy the U.S. claims to subscribe? Joining us now to discuss the complicated history of Taiwan and the future of U.S.-China relations is Dr. Bates Gill. He's the professor and department head of Macquarie University, and he's an expert on Chinese foreign policy and also was the former director of the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Dr. Gill, thank you for joining us. Now, Dr. Gill, China has had a dubious claim to Taiwan dating back to at least the 1300s. This has been disputed by some historians, but at the very least, China has had influence over the island since then. Present-day Beijing uses the term reunification when talking about Taiwan. Is this characterization accurate?
Well, I think the greatest aspiration, certainly as expressed by Xi Jinping repeatedly, is the so-called great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, which I interpret to mean a sort of return to China's past greatness, in which it is widely respected in the world, seen and accepted as a great power, and maybe most importantly, in which the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party is not only accepted by the world, but is indeed respected and even, they hope, appreciated by the international community. That's probably the grandest ambition of all. And, Xi has made it clear that he intends to drive forward across that grand ambition such that China would become, if not the most powerful and respected country in the world, then certainly among the most powerful and respected countries in the world.
But in modern times, it was the San Francisco Peace Treaty of 1951, which saw imperial Japanese colonization of Taiwan come to an end after the Allies defeated Japan in World War II. That treaty, signed by 48 nations. However, it failed to define Taiwan as independent, nor did it say who, if any country, Taiwan would be ceded to. And this leads us to the present day ambiguity of the sovereignty status of that island. The San Francisco Peace Treaty of 1951 was extremely flawed. Most of the 48 signatories agreed to sort of leave Taiwan in limbo and play it by ear, if you will. This ended the Japanese occupation, but didn't really define Taiwan's national status in a post-occupation world. So is independence thereby a default status if occupation comes to an end, according to the UN Charter?
Recall that China, mainland China, the People's Republic of China, was not even a member of the United Nations until 1971, and was, you know, really something of an outcast and isolated by the international community. And instead, the government on Taiwan, the nationalist government on Taiwan, was considered the legitimate government of China. Had a seat in the United Nations, was played a very, very major role in the post-World War II construction of the international community, etc. And, you know, with that kind of support, I think, yes, the communist leadership in China at the time, in the 50s and 60s, did believe that, you know, Taiwan may have been used as an instrument against it. Less so, I think, today, although that may be changing. Of course, there is now no official diplomatic relationship between the United States and Taiwan. The United States has been relatively clear and consistent in its messaging about Taiwan's status, that it does not support Taiwan's independence. Its principal interest is that the differences across the Taiwan Strait be settled peacefully and include, you know, the consent of the people of Taiwan. But that other than that, the United States official policy is that it does not have any sort of preferred outcome as long as it's peaceful and done with the consent and support of the people of Taiwan. So, you know, I wouldn't say it's a cudgel exactly, but I think increasingly clearly there is some concern that China may wish to resolve its differences with Taiwan through the use of force, in which case could well result in some form of American intervention to try and prevent that.
Now, the UK, for their part in this treaty, recognized the Beijing Communist Party, whereas the U.S. officially gave the island, quote, an undetermined status. Now, today, the United Nations, whose charter this treaty falls under, does not officially recognize Taiwan as an independent nation state. The principle of independence is easy to understand. It's a popular sentiment. But on the world stage, politically and economically, does full sovereignty and independence benefit Taiwan? Or would it be more beneficial to be reunited with the mainland?
You know, the fact is that depending on how you measure it, it's been well over a century or more that there has been no effective control of Taiwan by a government in the mainland. And so, you know, it's unavoidable then that, you know, with that passage of time, the people of Taiwan have felt increasingly less and less associated, you know, politically, surely, with mainland China. And I think that is really at the center of the differences across the Taiwan Strait about, you know, whether Taiwan should or should not be considered a part of mainland China.
So U.S. foreign policy seems to acknowledge the one China policy. This is in reference, obviously, to Taiwan and Hong Kong. But the Beijing government specifically told Nancy Pelosi that her visit was not welcome. According to the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson, Zhao Lijian, quote, "I want to reiterate that the one China principle is at the heart of China's core interest. No country, force, or individual shall ever underestimate the firm resolve, staunch will, and strong capability of the Chinese government and people to defend sovereignty and territorial integrity and to achieve national reunification and rejuvenation. Now, this came on the heels of President Biden's gaffe just a few months prior, saying that the U.S. would assist Taiwan militarily if China reunified the island by force. U.S.-China relations have grown continually icier over the last 6 years, locked in this trade war and even expressing U.S. goals of containing China. Where does this put the relationship between the world's top two superpower economies in the coming years?
Well, clearly the visit by the speaker, you know, has created increased tensions in the U.S.-China relationship. You know, I think there is probably some blame to be had on both sides of this question for the resulting, you know, increased tensions. It wasn't unprecedented. Obviously, the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives had visited Taiwan once before, you know, back in the 1990s when Newt Gingrich visited. So it's not entirely unprecedented. And I think, you know, the core message coming out of Washington is that this does not signal any fundamental change in those core elements of the U.S. policy toward Taiwan. But nevertheless, clearly controversial. Beijing, not happy, launched the massive military exercises against, you know, in, you know, around Taiwan as a signal of its unhappiness. And, you know, that's just led to even greater, Beijing signaled that it's pulling out of a variety of dialogue mechanisms with the United States. And so, you know, we see ourselves in a much, much more difficult situation between these two great powers, which of course is unfortunate. You know, congressional delegations have visited Taiwan for many, many years. This is nothing new. And so I think in a sense, we see a bit of overreaction, I would say, from Beijing on this. But of course, as you said, the United States and China relations were already in very, very difficult situation. And we see a worsening now as a result. And we can hope that the two countries could try and rebuild some of those guardrails and come to at least a more stable set of understandings with one another going forward.
Dr. Bates Gill, thank you so much for sharing your insight with us today. Coming up next, this tiny chain of islands in the South Pacific is suddenly on everyone's radar. Find out next why the Solomon Islands are being courted by both the United States and China. Stay tuned to the MO. We'll be right back.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
1950, the USSR was returning to peaceful life. But the newspapers didn't report ongoing massacres in the Ukrainian SSR. According to intelligence, Ukrainian nationalists and the Ukrainian insurgent army, led by Roman Shugievich, perpetrated these atrocities.
Shugievich уже дошел до того, что он в обращениях писал, что убивайте, убивайте, убивайте. То есть призывал просто убивать. И миллионы.
Pavel Sudoplatov was the head of the NKVD sabotage department at the time. He was tasked with stopping the atrocities in Ukraine for a good reason. General Sudoplatov was very familiar with the situation. He'd had experience fighting the nationalists before the war.
At this time, I was already an experienced man. Experienced in the counter-intelligence work, especially in Ukraine.
The task was tremendously difficult, but Sudoplatov was determined to complete it. He had personal accounts to settle with the Ukrainian nationalists.
There's a small island chain just off the coast of Sydney, Australia. The Solomon Islands, often overshadowed by better-known neighbors such as New Guinea and Fiji, are now creating waves in the South Pacific, largely forgotten by the West after the Battle of Guadalcanal in World War II. This island chain is garnering renewed interest by both China and the U.S. in recent months. China brokering a fishing deal that comes with a side of security pact that has put the Solomon Islands back on America's radar. Beijing offering Honiara security in the way of training the island's Royal Police Force and agreeing to have Chinese vessels visit the Solomon Island ports. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister of the islands, Manase Sogavare, says there will be no Chinese bases in his country and that Australia is still their security partner of choice, though a recent visit by Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi has advanced the island's ties to China both diplomatically and economically, with China promising infrastructure development in this rural country. Now, all this coming about a year after Australia signed the new AUKUS pact with the UK and US, angering France in the process. For its part, the U.S. is trying to revive old ties with the island, sending a top diplomatic delegation in early August. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman and daughter of a former U.S. president turned ambassador to Australia, Caroline Kennedy. Now, a young JFK, while serving in the Navy during World War II, nearly died in fighting on the islands and was rescued by island locals. The two dignitaries attended a World War II memorial service on August 8th and then planned to reopen the U.S. embassy on the island that was shuttered back in 1993. Coming with the envoys, USAID. Though officially described as the world's premier soft power humanitarian aid agency, with their mission statement citing building communities and advancing democracy, where USAID goes, the CIA follows. For more on what this diplomatic trip means and what USAID's presence implies is former CIA agent and whistleblower and also host of the new show of the same name, The Whistleblowers, is John Kiriakou. John, thank you so much for joining me on set.
Pleasure.
And congratulations on your new show.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to seeing
Excited
more of that. First, given your many years, your extensive history in the CIA, we know what the stated goals of USAID are, but what role do they play for the CIA?
Well, first, you have to look at what intelligence is. It really is very simply just information. And USAID, being a part of the State Department, really is one of the greatest intelligence providers to the CIA. Everything that a USAID officer writes makes its way back to the CIA through the State Department. And so USAID may be out there trying to do good works or, you know, building dams or digging wells or whatever, but eventually they're going to serve as a source of intelligence for the CIA. So even though they may not meet with CIA personnel, they may not be involved directly with the CIA, indirectly, they're quite important.
Well, the CIA then is obviously America's top spy and PSYOP agency. There are countless coups, color revolutions, riots that are left in the wake anywhere the agency goes. I mean, just look at South America back in the 1980s as the most obvious and admitted role of the CIA and the bloodbath that happened there. Why might the CIA have interest now in the Solomon Islands?
It's all about China. You know, the CIA really hasn't had a presence in the Solomon Islands, and indeed, until recently, we didn't even have an embassy in the Solomon Islands. We had closed it. But the Solomon Islands are very important to Australia, and Australia, of course, is very important to the United States. And over the years, the last decades, as China has become ascendant, everything in the Pacific Rim region has become more and more important to the CIA as an intelligence issue. If the CIA can in some way impede Chinese development or expansion, even in a little place like the Solomon Islands, they're willing to give it a try. And that's why all of a sudden the Solomon Islands are very important to the United States.
Yeah, or impede Chinese influence.
Indeed. You know, the United States has the Monroe Doctrine, where we view any foreign military attack on any country in North, Central, or South America as an attack on the United States. Well, with the same logic, the Chinese, ought to have respected their own sphere of influence. At least that's the Chinese point of view.
Right. I mean, on a map, that would make sense.
Right.
Well, so USAID is currently led by Samantha Power. She is an Obama administration darling. At one time, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., also a former advisor to President Obama on his National Security Council. A lot of people place the ongoing, the still ongoing crisis in Yemen at her feet, squarely at her feet. She herself has lamented that President Obama didn't do enough in Syria as she advised him. She's very frequently labeled a war hawk.
Oh, yes.
Now she leads the country's so-called humanitarian aid agency. How do you square her appointment in the Biden administration with this new interest in the Solomons?
Oh, this makes complete sense to me. The fact that Samantha Power heads an organization like USAID is an example of an extension of what scholars might call soft power. First of all, you're exactly right. Samantha Power is a longtime war hawk. She's one of the most neoliberals in a neoliberal administration.
That's saying a lot.
It's saying a lot. She really was responsible for the war in Yemen. She was in part responsible for the war in Syria. She was in part responsible for the war in Libya. This is her foreign policy, her personal foreign policy beliefs. Now, at USAID, she's able to exert U.S. soft power in the form of international development, as I said a few minutes ago, building bridges and digging wells and building roads and hospitals and electrical grids and sewage systems as a way to expand the U.S. footprint all over the world, including in the Solomon Islands. So the fact that she has these pro-war views makes perfect sense to me when the United States is using every thing in its arsenal to confront the Chinese. She would be the person to do that.
Yeah, I found that such an interesting air quotes, appointment to USAID.
I agree.
Now, the Chinese, they view the Solomons as their neighbor. It's a country in their hemisphere, as we mentioned. If you look on a map, pretty simple. Mm-hmm. There's cause for that relationship to strengthen. What reason does the U.S. have for wanting presence on this tiny island way over on the other side of the ocean?
Well, the U.S. thinking is twofold. Number one, the Australians have asked us to become involved. And because the Australians are panicked about the Chinese, we were more than happy to do that. But secondly, you have to look at the broader U.S. policy toward China. We made a conscious decision, probably going as far back as the Reagan administration, to challenge China at every opportunity, whether it's Chinese expansion or globalization or whatever it is. You know, one of the things that we're having trouble confronting is the Chinese are not going around the world to spread an ideology. They're going around the world to build things.
Right.
Roads, ports, as I said. They're truly assisting in the economic development of a lot of countries that really do need economic development. That's something that the United States has been unwilling to do. We say that we don't have the money for it. The truth is we have plenty of money. We've chosen to spend it on,
on
military hardware.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Allocate it somewhere else.
And so we're having trouble confronting the Chinese on this because they've chosen to not spend it on military hardware. So the Chinese, as you said, view the Solomon Islands certainly within their sphere of influence. Now the Solomons are led by somebody who is open to improving relations with China, and we're panicking.
Yeah, and I'll add one thing to that, John, which I find kind of interesting, is that about a year ago, I think it was December of 2021, there was a riot in what effectively was a Chinatown of the Solomon Islands. One of the islands of the chain of islands, I forget what they call them, there's one prime minister, but there's effectively a governor of that particular island. Mm-hmm. It's very pro-Taiwan, very anti-China, and there is talk that they're also pro-America, pro-Australia, against any Chinese influence, mm-hmm. and that they might have had something to do with that riot. What do you say about that?
You know, I wouldn't discount that. It was only in the last few years that the Solomon Islands decided to withdraw their recognition of Taiwan at the United Nations and recognize mainland China as the official representative of the Chinese people. So we're talking about momentous foreign policy changes in that tiny country. I could see something like that being the case.
So it wouldn't be.
I think it's believable.
Right. It wouldn't be out of the ordinary, especially now that USAID has expressed interest, mm-hmm. And we know certainly that CIA is going to be interested. I don't want to ask you to predict the future, but would it be reasonable to say that perhaps there might be some unrest, maybe a coup, maybe some sort of revolution, maybe independence?
Yeah, that's always possible. But I also think we should watch to see what the Australians are going to do, because I think that if the Australians see the Solomons heading down that path, mm-hmm. that path toward violence or revolution, I wouldn't be surprised if the Australians begin pouring in massive amounts of money just to keep the Solomons at bay and to keep them away from the Chinese before a coup. I could see a coup happening eventually.
Right. You got to give USAID some time, John. All right, we will leave that right there. John Kiriakou, host of the brand new show, The Whistleblowers, thank you for making some time to be here, shedding some light on this very important subject, especially given your years and years of CIA experience. Thank you, John.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that is going to do it for this week's episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next week to figure out the MO.